Hey, everybody, on this episode of I Talk Movies, we're getting up close and personal with the director Diego Halavis. Let's do it.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's I Talk Movies.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Rolling Stones play us in to this episode of I Talk Movies. Why that is, you'll find out in just a moment. I'm your host, Frank Moran. Now, folks, we're going to learn a lot about my guest here in just a moment. But if you also want to learn and have fun and grow in all areas of your life, for those that do, that we've got a podcast just for you. Conversations with Maria Menounos podcast edition is hosted by our AfterBuzz TV founder, Maria Menounos, and drops every Friday on iTunes. Conversations with Maria Menounos features celebrity and influencer interviews, along with secrets and tips on how to be better in all aspects of life, from health and wellness to career and relationships, finances, and more. Let our Maria be the big sister you never had. Just go to iTunes and subscribe to Conversations with Maria Menounos for free. Be sure to rate and comment, and when you do, let Maria know that it was us who got you there. Conversations with Maria Menounos, podcast edition. Check it out. My guest today is a director who got a start in the field of advertising, but then went into film. His short film, The Laughing Man, as well as his proof of concept film, Shifter, both went viral, and now he's got a new film coming out. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Curvature. It is coming out February 23rd, it is now available to be seen. We'll find out more from our guest right now. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Diego Halavis.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So first, before we get into everything here, is you have a production company, yep. 1 in a Million Production.
Yep.
I'm always curious about, in terms of how people come up with their production company name and the logo. How did that, what was the inspiration for?
Well, the idea was, like, you know, in order to make it in this industry, you just gotta keep trying and then be one of that million times that makes it happen. So, you know, just keep doing it until it happens.
So, now, growing up, was filmmaking always something that you would aspire to? Are you one of those, very much like a Steven Spielberg, that had like a video camera or a camcorder that was going around shooting things with your friends?
I wasn't that young when the film bug sort of, like, bit me. I was more in my, you know, like 12 or 13. And there was this movie that came out in Mexico, Amores Perros. And when I watched it, it really just, like, I think that was like a specific moment in my life where, like, my path sort of, like, shifted, maybe without even knowing it, because I was too young at the time. But I just watched that movie and I was like, oh, this is a thing that, you know, as a Mexican, you can also make. You don't have to be someone in Hollywood making films. And then the year after that, Y Tu Mamá También came out. And that was another movie that also, like, moved me in that sense where, you know, it made me, you know, maybe a little bit more mature and aware of certain themes that maybe at that time I was too young to sort of, like, realize by myself. And then I realized the power of movies, you know, what they have and what they can make, you know, go through internally and sort of, like, mature. And then I realized, you know, storytelling and then, you know, the technical aspect behind it. And then little by little, it just became, like, this passion that took over my life, really.
So you grew up in Mexico?
I grew up in Mexico, and then around the age of 12, I moved to Florida with my family. So I've been, like, in the U.S. and in Mexico.
So when this bug starts happening, it happens when you're in Mexico. What are there avenues and things for you to up until 12 years old to kind of start exploring and discovering as a filmmaker? Or was it really until Florida and you got a little older that you had more access?
Well, funny enough, when those movies came out, I had been in the U.S. already for about a year. So it was when I went back for the summer break to, like, go visit family and friends that I watched them. And then it sort of almost made me realize, like, wait, I'm in Florida, which is, like, closer to Hollywood than it was, you know, living in Mexico. So, yeah, it slowly became a thing where I was like, okay, this is a thing I can pursue.
And did you pursue it in Florida?
Yes, I did. I went to film school in Florida, to Florida Atlantic University.
Oh, excellent. And for that, was that something that your parents were they surprised or that you wanted to pursue something in film? Or were they like, well, yeah, we could tell Diego's always got that. We can tell how passionate he is about this. It makes sense that this is what he wanted to pursue as a career.
Yeah, I mean, I think also as a kid, I was the type of kid who would rewatch movies over and over. And so they realized that I had some sort of passion for movies in a way. They just didn't know I was going to pursue it professionally. And when I decided to tell them, you know, they were really supportive. I think it also helped that at the time I was also majoring in engineering as well as film. So they sort of felt like I had a plan B.
Yeah.
But in my head, I just knew like it was never going to be a thing. It was just sort of like to appease them.
How is engineering kind of, even though that's not what you pursued as a career, but how has it come into play just in terms of being a filmmaker?
Well, you know, film, I think, is one of the few professions out there where it's art meets technology and engineering in a sense. So I guess the way that I taught myself filmmaking, because even though I went to film school, I went to a film school that gives you a lot of theory, it's not really a technical school. So the engineering background helped me sort of like reverse engineer how to like filmmaking works. So I taught myself how to edit, you know, using YouTube tutorials and stuff like that. And then, you know, you realize that it is a very technical skill set that you need in the sense of, you know, breaking down storyboards and, you know, how to the coverage, the setups, and then music, you know, all the different tracks that you have in the editing software. You realize it's sort of like engineering a story. Right?
Yeah. Because I feel like with modern technology, the way it's gone, where everybody says, like, just, you know, you can use the cell phone in your hand to film something. So anybody can become a filmmaker.
I kind of don't like it when people say that a mm-hmm. lot, because whenever you hear that story, it's movies that, oh, this movie was shot with an iPhone. But then when you watch the behind the scenes, you see, like, the massive rig the phone has. And it has, like, professional lenses. And it has an adapter for those lenses. And, you know, it's going to a hard drive. And it does go into, like, color correction. Things that someone with just an iPhone doesn't have, you know? So technically, yes, you can shoot a movie with an iPhone. But not all the movies that you watch that are shot with an iPhone really is just an iPhone.
But I feel the modern age in terms of just the internet has made it so much easier for somebody that is interested and curious to be able to explore, where you could find YouTube tutorials on a variety of different things. Things, you know, like, gosh, you know, 20, 30 years ago would be incredibly difficult. That's something going, you know, reading magazines, like, you know, or going to the library if you didn't have access to a higher education. How's it been just in terms of growing up where you've had more information more readily to your fingertips as you're learning about this medium?
Absolutely. I feel like nowadays, even more when I started, you can even see, you know, younger kids in YouTube using After Effects and you know, doing certain things, the web series that, you know, maybe 10 years ago were not possible. And then you're right. I don't think nowadays you need to go to an expensive film school to become a filmmaker, because all that information is out there available. And like you said, technology has gotten better to the point where, you know, editing softwares and tutorials and how to make your little movie look more professional has become more accessible. So, you know, I'm really jealous about the younger generation right now. Yeah. I was sort of like in between. Moment when I was in my 20s, where digital cameras were not really, they hadn't really made the break. It was, you know, still film and you know, tape. And then it was a little later that you know, the Red and the Alexa really took over.
Were you doing any of the splicing and taping together for any of the film, or no?
I did some of that in film school, and yeah. I did some courses that, you know, like Kodak would offer, because, you know, they're always trying to, you know, promote using film. But, you know, realistically, when you're making indie films, it doesn't really make sense to use film just because it's so expensive that it's become a luxury, really, to shoot on film.
Is that whole process and the I guess it's more tactile, where you're holding the actual film, the reel that you're working with, and cutting it and splicing it together. Is there something about that that's kind of cool that you're like, well, I mean, certainly in indie films or just, you know, just through the progression of technology, you kind of lose some of those old Hollywood kind of styles and ways. Do you kind of feel like I missed having the opportunity to do that, or you're like, I'm super happy with the advances in technology?
I'll tell you what it is. It's less about when you're cutting it in post-production. I think it's more about when you're on set. When you're on set and you're shooting on film, I think there's a discipline that on the set, people realize that you're shooting on film, and so don't waste a take. Whereas, suppose when you're in digital, sometimes you don't even like cut it. You just keep rolling and maybe improvise. Whereas when you're shooting on film, you know you have like a certain amount of shots, and so you want to make them count. And people know that. So I think people come at it with a different attitude, and maybe it's a little bit more serious.
Is that both for crew members as well as cast?
Absolutely.
Where the cast feel like they've got to be on their A game. They can't just, because they know they don't have takes, just kind of find the scene.
That goes on both ends, for sure.
So you finish school out in Florida, and do you immediately start pursuing jobs in advertising right out of the gate? Or what made you decide that advertising might be a good first step into doing more filming?
Well, while I was in film school and even high school, I was already interning for production companies because I was just like hungry to learn. So, you know, I became a PA. And what's really available in Florida is productions for commercials, music videos, advertising. So that's why that was sort of like my foundation. And then from there, you know, I realized, okay, you can make a living out of this for a little bit until you find your footing in film. So that's how that sort of started.
And I know we were talking just a little bit before we started rolling on this, where if you go to school to be a dentist or a lawyer or a doctor, there's pretty much like a set structure for everything. But it does feel like if you're pursuing something in the film, or whether it be in television as well, in production, we'll just say, that what you learn in school and then you actually start to go out to pursue that career, it's not – you're doing many other things that you may not even really have dealt with in school, that you're kind of just learning on the fly as you go.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like if most film schools were honest about it, they would not have a lot of students coming in and signing up for film classes. So I think they need to play a little bit on the romanticism of film. You know, there's only a couple of film schools in the U.S. that really make a difference in your career if you go to them. And it's mostly because of the people that go there. If you get to know them at that point in your life and they actually end up becoming someone, then you have an access to reach out to somebody and be like, hey, do you want to help me out? Or if it's someone who becomes a showrunner, then he could maybe give you an episode to direct. You know, it happens a lot. 50% of making it is talent, 50% is luck and who you know, and you know the timing that might come up, something might come up, and you might jump on it.
So while you're doing, while you're PAing for these advertising agencies, while you're still in school, was that kind of giving you a leg up? So you kind of, when you graduated, you had a better idea of what to expect after post graduation.
Well, it helps you realize, like when you're in advertising, that you know there's the product and then there's the talent agency, and you gotta sort of like appease them. And then it sort of really helped me get my footing in editing. When I first moved to LA, I was a freelance editor for advertising, and having already that school of thought for how to please the client really made it easy for me to like come here and make a living right away.
Is it a constant challenge to always appease a client or please them while you're doing some kind of campaign?
I think it's challenging because sometimes you might get a creative note from, oh, you know, the creative's wife saw the spot and she thinks you should change it and make this. And, you know, you don't really know what her experience might be in a commercial. So you have to listen to certain things. But at the same time, I think because it's a commercial and it's not really your baby, it's not your story, it's not, then it's sort of like a transaction. And it's like, okay, that's what you want, I'll make it happen. Sometimes, you know, if you see that it's a note that is going to make the product worse, you make two versions and you're like, here's your version, here's the version that I think you might like. And then maybe that way they're more open-minded and might like your version better.
I have to mention that there is just that you learning what is worth fighting for, the battles that are worth fighting for, and the other ones that are just like, okay, we're just going to let this go. This is not an important element of that. And I feel like that has got to be so instrumental, especially as an indie filmmaker, that there are things that you absolutely want to fight for. And then I imagine there are things that are just like, well, just let it go and move on.
You're absolutely right. You know, part of filmmaking is, you know, your vision and the story that you're trying to tell. But the big part of it also is people skills that you need to have on set with either actors or, you know, crew members. And you sort of learn to navigate that you're talking to people. You're not talking to machines. And at first, I was very much about like, oh, this is my vision and you're there to support my vision and you got to do this. And the more you start working with people and different projects, you realize that your real job is to create an environment where your crew members can be better, you know? So that way they can help you elevate the material. But you got to provide an environment for them to feel safe and creative to either, you know, give you a different idea of what you thought you wanted, you know? And then that way, that's when it's a collaboration, you know? People like to, you know, tell the directors, the captain of the ship, and he's like this mastermind. But in reality, there's all these different departments working together. And that is really when a movie becomes bigger than the sum of its parts. It's because everyone somehow creatively was able to find something that, you know, made the story better.
When you're on set, just as a PA, just kind of seeing all the filming happening and how sets are run, What are things that you took away that's like, when I have my own set and I'm running a production, I want to make sure I'm running the set like this to make sure I make it as a good environment as everybody, for everybody involved?
It's tricky because there is a hierarchy in the sense of like, you know, this is the department head and the department has all these other people underneath him or her. And so I think what you need to take away from that is you need to have authority, but at the same time, you got to be respectful and you can't make people feel bad. I've been in situations as a PA where I was yelled at and treated really bad. And, you know, everyone's there because they just want to be part of it. Everyone's there because they're for their passion of storytelling and filmmaking. You know, and when you're a PA, you're really like at the bottom, you know? And so there's people, I mean, it's really hard work, and sometimes people don't treat you like a human being, you know? Right, yeah. Especially because this is one of the few fields where they know they can get away with doing that because people's passion for doing, I mean, if you're an assistant to a dentist and you treat them like that, they're just going to walk away like that day.
Yeah.
Whereas PAs, they just need to like sort of like take it and keep going because they just want to learn and be there. So, yeah.
That's true. It's like, I'll find another dentist. That's fine. It's always hard to feel like, it's so much harder to find, like, I'll find another production to work on. It's not always that easy.
That's what I'm saying.
I feel like you those sets that are run by where there's a lot of yelling or just putting people down, I feel like, how do you expect to get the best out of everybody working for you if they're operating out of a sense of fear rather than a chance to really be passionate and invested?
I mean, for some people, I guess it works fine. I think if you were doing like a big blockbuster movie, I kind of understand that it's like sort of like this big machine and you sort of like have to steer people along the way. I do think there's ways of being nice about it. But there's also that fine line where if you're too nice, people start taking advantage. It's really tricky.
Were you somebody that wants, did you have like, I want to be kind of overseeing everything, that control freak sense, and then realizing that you have to just trust the people that you're working with and be able to step back and feel like you don't have to micromanage everything. You can trust their opinions and input to you.
I think it's less about micromanaging and it's more about if you have the knowledge, as much knowledge as you can get for each different department, then you can talk to each department head in their terms, right? As opposed to, you know, you going to the DP and not knowing anything about lenses or lighting, then it's going to be really hard for him to understand what is it that you're trying to get,
mm-hmm.
you know, what type of visual. So if you learn about that medium as much as you can, then you can start talking in his or her terms. And then it's a more interesting conversation, right? Because there's less of a learning curve and it's more of a creative talk.
Yeah, which I imagine for things like lenses or working with the DP, that things that going to school, kind of have, you're learning those things along the way. But say costume design, working with the stylist or the wardrobe person, things that you may not have had much experience with in school and now having to take the time to kind of learn as much as you can about that, to have those kind of meeting eye to eye kind of conversations. What's it like when you get a chance to kind of just, I think that'd be the fun part of being a director, is to be able to dive into those areas you maybe didn't get into as much in school, but now you get a chance to kind of learn more about these other facets that play a part in a larger production.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I realized the moment I decided I was going to become a filmmaker is that, you know, when you do your first couple of shorts and you have no clue what you're doing, and then it forces you to start thinking in terms of that, like custom design and production design, you know, architecture. And then all of a sudden I realized my mind just like expanded and I was thinking about those things that I used to never show any interest for. And then you start looking at it differently. And then every building then becomes a potential location that you look at. Every time you're on vacation, you picture, oh, I'm in the jungle. This would be a great scene. And then you start learning more about nature and stuff like that just because you're sort of doing research for a film. Oh, that's a great dress. It'd be great if I did a time period movie and it had that sort of look. And it sort of makes you realize that every art form can be part of a film. So you start gaining appreciation for things that you never thought you would even care for.
Are you? Is it very much like being a writer, where they will carry, whether it be like their iPhone to speak into for the microphone to record something, or have a notepad to jot things down? When you're on a vacation, or you're just in life, just kind of just doing your day-to-day things, and you see an environment or a piece of clothing or something like that that kind of inspires you, do you take the time to kind of jot those things down, or are you just kind of catalog it in your head and hopefully it gets recalled at some point?
I absolutely take pictures every time I go somewhere where I feel like every time you walk to a place and you think to yourself, oh, this could be a scene, this could be a movie, then you remember it. It sort of like goes in the back of your head. And then when you're writing, you draw inspirations from that, you know?
I feel like that is the nice thing about having with smartphones now and the big storage space, that you can, again, the difference of shooting on film as opposed to digital, where you can take as many photos as you want of everything. So if you find something that kind of is inspirational to you, shoot the heck out of it, and then you don't have to worry. It's like, I only got this roll of film is only 13 photos left. I got to be careful about what I'm shooting.
Yeah, absolutely. The only thing about that is that then all of a sudden you have like so many pictures and you don't even realize what you took it, because you're like, why? This is horrible. Why did I even like this? But, you know, there's the good ones. You know, for one good one, there's maybe 10 bad ones.
So when you decided to make the move from Florida to L.A., is that just... Is it that you could stay in Florida and kind of be a big fish in a small pond, or is it just by the nature of production itself that you really, at some point, you have to make the move to LA?
I do think that, you know, first before going from Florida to LA, I did spend some time in New York, you know, I did, you know, because of production and advertising and stuff like that. And, you know, it makes you realize how much, you know, how many different doors opened for me when I was just there for 6 months. And then I was like, I want this experience, but from LA, you know, LA has always been that place I've seen in films and you've known about. I just want to go there. And yeah, when you get here, you realize that within a year, the amount of connections and people that you meet that, you know, you have so much in common with, it's 10 times more than than the people that I met for 10 years in Florida, you know? So it is really the Mecca here. And if you're not willing to move out here, maybe you should definitely spend your summers over here, you know? The internet is great as well to make connections, but a lot of the times you just encounter people that, you know, you met at a bar and then he's a writer and you sort of like hit it off. And then next thing you know, you've got two screenplays you've developed together, you know?
So your time in New York compared to out here, what is it sort of the film industry in terms of, you said things kind of your world kind of opened up in New York, but not as much as compared to here in LA. What do you think the difference is between New York and LA in terms of filmmaking?
I think it's just culture. I think it's just culturally, and the types of films that get made over there are a little different than the ones that are made over here, just simply because of the type of culture that exists over there. It's a melting pot as well, here and there. They're both very eclectic places, but they sort of like brew different types of people just because of the sort of vibe that LA offers and the vibe that New York offers. It's all it is. It's just different vibes, but you know, it's like food, different flavors, that's but it's true. Still food.
So when you move out here and you start working, first as an editor, when do you say like, all right, I've got something that I want to actually invest my time on and start making my own production from beginning to end?
It's baby steps. It's not just one day where you just are able to open top and you know, you sort of start making like little commercials. My brother's my producing partner, and he, while I was being an editor for advertising, he was producing car commercials. So it was sort of like joining each other's experience and connections. And so you start off making, you know, a couple commercials here and there, a couple music videos here and there. You start offering your production services, and then little by little, you're able to create a company. And then at that point, then that's when you quit your full-time job and jump ahead and say, this is what I'm doing.
I feel like that is always the most scariest moment, I think, for somebody to feel like, okay, that's it. I've reached this point where, yes, I can make the leap and feel good about it, not have to worry about, like, I've got to keep this other job that I'm doing just as a fallback position. It's got to be both an exciting and scary moment, I would think.
I think it's scarier never making that jump. That, to me, is scarier. That, to me, is what scares me, not pursuing your dream. Because, like, if you've try and you can't, you know, you didn't do it, at least you tried. And then if you keep trying, eventually you'll find some sort of success. To me, it's scarier not even taking the leap.
Do you feel like if passion will win out in the end, as long if you have that intense passion, and certainly you have to have talent to back it up, but if you have that passion and you may remain steadfast in pursuing it, that at least some doors will open for you in the film industry?
Absolutely. I think it's passion, and it's also, you gotta be very stubborn. You have to be extremely stubborn, because you're gonna be rejected a lot. whether it's, you know, film festivals or whether it's financiers to get your movie going. So it's being able to understand that, you know, if you keep trying, things will happen. But whenever you start getting rejected, you know, emotionally, you might start feeling down or whatever and not wanting to keep pursuing your goal. And I think it's a combination of the passion that you have that fuels you. So that way you're stubborn and you keep, you know, someone says no, okay, you turn around, you keep going. No, okay, you turn around. You know, you keep knocking on doors until one of them opens. And if they don't open, then you find the one that you can kick down and walk right in.
So now I feel like part of that helps is having a great support system. People that you that are in your corner that you can get support from them when you need it. Your brother, as you mentioned, your producing partner for One in a Million Productions, did he follow the same path from you from Florida to New York to out here to L.A.? Did you kind of do that together, or was that both kind of separate things that both eventually led you to L.A.?
No, absolutely. He has been definitely my strongest supporter, as well as, you know, partner in crime, I guess. He produced my very first short film, and he's produced everything ever since, including my commercials and everything. So it's this dynamic where we sort of like complement each other, and it does help whenever you're making big steps like moving to LA or something like that, where you're not alone, right? And then when there's those days where you're just like so frustrated and you don't know what to do, there's somebody that you can talk to, and they can relate to you in that same personal level. I think that's a key component, is to remember that filmmaking is not a thing that you do on your own. It's mm-hmm. it's a collaboration with different people, and having one of them in your corner who's completely loyal to you, as well as you to him, definitely makes things a lot easier.
So your brother Julio and yourself, you mentioned that you complement each other. Where do you think each other kind of shore each other up in terms of strengths and weaknesses?
I think for me and him, it's sort of like a Venn diagram, where like I come from like a very creative part, you know, editing and stuff like that. He comes more from the business side of things, but he's also a creative producer in the sense that, you know, whenever we're developing screenplays, we are definitely talking creative before we start talking budget. And then once we sort of like agree on the story, then he starts breaking it down, saying like, well, this is not going to happen because this is so expensive. And then, let's figure it out. And then he comes up with like different solutions. And so, you know, in that sense, he's applying that business mentality to be creative. And on my side, I apply my creative sensibilities to see how business-wise it can make sense.
I feel like that's the necessary. It's great to have somebody that can approach from the business side, but also has a creative element where it's not just, nope, you can't do it, we can't afford this, and then that's it. That somebody that can say, well, we can't afford this, but we could try this instead. What about this? That at least is offering some solutions or ideas that could, if maybe that's not the final idea, but at least sparks an idea between the two of you that can lead to the final result.
Absolutely, and I think that also comes from the fact that, you know, we've watched so many films together growing up that it was sort of like in the nature already in this like relationship that we had, is we grew up watching films together. He has his point of views, I have my points of views, but we both sort of like the same things at the same time. So
one of the short films you did, The Laughing Man,
yeah,
based on the early days of the Joker. Surprisingly, wearing a Batman t-shirt, I'm a huge comic book nut. What was it that led you to say, like, I'd like to do kind of a short film about focusing on the early days of the Joker?
Well, the Joker is by far my favorite character. I think there's something very interesting about him, just because he's a villain, but he's really smart. And, you know, what I wanted to do is make a short sort of like love letter to him, that I knew the studios would never do, just because the type of, you know, structure in which they have to work and operate is making big blockbuster movies that, you know, need to make a lot of money and sell a lot of toys and video games. And now, even more than ever, it needs to be part of like this franchise that, you know, it's sort of like it needs to spill through 10 films.
Yep.
Right? And so I wanted to make a movie where like the Joker was the main protagonist, where Batman doesn't show up, and it's really about him, right? Whatever his points of views are. And he's so twisted that to me, I think like there's beauty in his madness, right? So I wanted to make something that I knew that was never going to get made unless I did it. You know, I wanted to make a hard R type of story, and, you know, I just went for it.
I feel like the short films, though, especially when they're talking about like genre things, whether it be comic books or sci-fi properties, are fantastic, because I feel like it's scratching that itch of those focusing on those characters or those relationships that often in big blockbusters, when they're come from the studios, are kind of lost. And it's always nice to have those indie filmmakers making those, because it gives those fans like, yes, I've always wanted to see a story focused on the character from this point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I still today get a bunch of messages through the YouTube channel in which she's playing, and they're asking me, like, can you make part two? Can you make part three? Like, we love it, you know? So, yeah, it's definitely it's out there, and people love it, and they want more. Obviously, you know, it's expensive to make them, so I can't just make them for fun, but...
For you, in your enthusiasm for the Joker, does it come from the TV show, the Batman 66? Does it come more from the films, the comic books? Is it a combination of all three?
It really came from the fact that when I watched The Dark Knight, mm-hmm. and Heath Ledger's interpretation of the Joker and the way that that story was taken seriously, it was in sort of like, you know, the previous Batman films that are, you know, very colorful but very cartoonish. This took a very grounded approach to his madness. And I was just like blown away. So I started doing like more research on the Joker, and I realized that there's different versions of the Joker based on the comic book that you're watching, right? There's the faceless one that I did. There's just different ones. And then I realized like the Joker has so much potential, but it's never been exploited. It's never been like, because yeah, he's a villain. And so how do you sell a villain commercially to mass audiences, right? I think, you know, I'm really excited to. I think Todd Phillips is going to be making an origin story. I'm really excited to see what they do with that.
Yeah, it'll be curious to see, you know, for a feature length, if you can follow that. But then do you want to see a Batman involved in the Joker origin story?
No, not at all. I wouldn't be interested. Maybe the studio would. But to me, I want to see what the Joker has to say. I want to see, like, personally, if I had, like, you know, best case scenario, and I could tell my Joker story like with that studio budget, I would make like a Bonnie and Clyde meets Fight Club of the Joker and Harley, and sort of like how they take over a city with a gang of clowns. I think it'd be super dope to see something like that and not have any other superheroes show up.
that actually is really interesting. All right. So now, of course, we've got Curvature, your latest film right here. This deals with time travel. We talked about before. I mentioned I'm a huge time travel nut. You said you are as well. Where, what are things in terms of time travel, in terms of TV shows, films, stories that have kind of sparked that enthusiasm for that genre?
Well, if you look at every different type of time travel movie that's out there, time travel to me, it's its own genre, just because you could apply it in so many different ways. You can go forwards, you can go backwards. And so a movie like Back to the Future is so different than something like Looper. You know, or any, you know, time crimes. So time travel is just sort of like the secret sauce that you put on the story to create something that makes you bend the rules of physics and time. But it allows you to explore it either as a drama, as a thriller, as a, you know, crazy, you know, vantage. Well, no, Vantage probably wasn't time travel, but what's that one?
Just Hot Tub Time Machine.
Hot Tub Time Machine, exactly. Yeah. Like the way you approach it, it just can be so different. So that's what I like about time travel movies.
So I always feel like with time travel, the most important thing is that, at least for me, it's like I want to make sure, like, structurally, everything makes sense in terms of if you're going to introduce time travel, whatever your rules for that particular form of time travel are that exists in the story you're telling, that everything remains consistent, that you could track all those picks. For you, as you're developing this film, was that something that you wanted to make sure, like, all right, if we're doing time travel and we're introducing this to the story, we've got to make sure that everything makes sense?
Absolutely. You need to make a strong decision on what are your rules for time travel. Because, again, each movie deals with its own different rules because time travel hasn't been invented. So you sort of like have to stick to your own sandbox and play within that. I don't like to spoon feed the audience the timeline. I think it's interesting, especially when it comes to time travel movies, that if you get to rewatch the movie, now that you know how it ended, that you're able to track certain things that you didn't see the first time. That's one of the gifts of making a time travel movie.
So you guys did not write this film, but you're directing and producing it. For the writer, where did you first meet in terms of wanting to collaborate together on this project?
We know Brian for a couple of years now, and we've developed actually multiple projects together. We've done some TV shows, some screenplays, some horror, some sci-fi, and the idea was sort of to like, you know, you don't want to just write one movie and be like, unless I make this movie, I'm not making any other movie, because then you're sort of like getting screwed. You're screwing yourself by doing that. So this was one of different projects that we had going on. And the success of Laughing Man going viral definitely allowed us to you know, get some interest in some investors. And so that one was the best match for sort of like the like at that time.
So as you were all kind of developing the script and talking about, because time travel, especially if any story or film or TV show that you've watched, so many different ways that you could apply the laws of time travel. They've been, as you mentioned, interpreted in so many different ways. How did you guys decide, like, we want to interpret it this way? We want to put like a 36-hour window in terms of what you could time travel interpreting. What made you decide to kind of come up with those kind of structures for the way you wanted to interpret time
travel? Well, the idea was, again, like you said, there's so many time travel movies. How do you approach it differently? And so what we wanted to do is do a character-centric time travel movie that dealt with emotions as opposed to, like, really changing the outcome of something and having, like, a domino effect. It was more about, if you could go backwards in time, then the way you perceive things emotionally changes over time. You know, I think time is something that allows you to heal emotionally. And so, you know, this is a movie where the protagonist is she's coping with the loss of her husband. And so having two versions of her character, but one that has had the, you know, time in between, sort of puts them in different spectrums emotionally, whereas mm-hmm. one is coping with loss and the other one's more active and it's very, like, on a mission. I thought that was very interesting.
Well, when you introduce the idea of being able to somebody that's grieving, and you introduce the concept like, hey, you could travel through time, it becomes just, you know, like almost like, how could you not want to go back and try to change this thing that is making you grieve right now?
Exactly.
And whether you do it for good or for ill, that, I guess, that is, you know, that's a struggle that character has to go through in terms of this production. So for this, when you're putting out all these structures for this, I guess the idea is like, well, first, how do they travel through time? Is that something that was essential to you to kind of figure out what's our mechanism for making this event occur? Or is that something like how they do it doesn't really matter? We just want to focus more on the characters, and as long as we address it in some fashion, that's good enough.
That was absolutely the second thing you mentioned was the way we approached it, because, you know, the audience is going to jump on some sort of big idea in the film, and that wasn't really what the film is about. The film is not about, how do you make time travel possible? The idea is, like, it's already possible in some prototype. Now, what can happen if someone goes back? So the science behind that, I don't think it's as interesting as much as, like, the outcome or the side effect of someone doing that.
For you, dealing with it as an independent film, I mean, you're dealing with the ideas of a really cool concept, but also dealing with the realistic nature of a budget. And as you mentioned, working with your brother, that you go for your pie in the sky first draft, and then you got to start revising once you start adding real world budgets into this. What was the kind of pie in the sky version to where it got now? Was there a lot of reductions, or the initial concept was still strong enough that it didn't require too much paring down to get to where you are at now?
No, you definitely start, you know, it's a combination of many things, right? Like, ideally, even without even going to the sci-fi aspect of it, when you write a movie, for example, all the scenes that take place in her house, you know, are blocked a certain way that it's a house that you sort of, like, imagine, and you're just writing it down. And then when it comes down to you're doing scouts and you start finding different homes and you're like, oh, this is a home that I like, but the layout is nothing like how it's written. So you have to sort of rewrite the scene for that. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of that's applies, you know, to almost every scene.
Well, of course, what's going to make it is the cast. And you've got two legendary actors in here. You've got Linda Hamilton and Glenn Moshauer playing in there. How did you entice the two of them to come join you on this production?
It really came down to them reading the screenplay and responding to it. Linda Hamilton was a strong advocate towards making films where the protagonist is a female character, but she's strong. She's not overly sexualized, and she doesn't fall to the tropes that most Hollywood films do to female protagonists. And so she really wanted to support it.
What I do like is that the write-up in terms of the cast and crew for this, I liked Linda's because it just really buries the lead. Like, it's like, oh, you know, she grew up and she wanted to pursue this. Oh, by the way, you may know her from, like, you know, the Terminator films and, you know, Beauty and the Beast. You may have heard of that. I did like the write-up for that. It's like, I knew who Linda Hamilton is. You don't know?
No, it was crazy. When I found out that she was interested in doing it, I was like, I couldn't believe it. Because when they told me, like, should we send the screenplay out? I was like, yeah, sure. But I, you know, you sort of, like, guard yourself so that way if she says no, you're not too, like, devastated. And then when she said yes, everything changed. And the first time I met her, literally the first thing she did was just give me a hug and be like, congratulations on your movie. And she's that type of person. She's just so nice. Every time she was on set, she would take pictures with all the crew members and she would have lunch with everyone. And, you know, when she shot all her scenes, people were sad that she was leaving. And she's sort of like that type of energy.
That which is what you always hope for when you get to have somebody of that caliber coming into production. That the idea that you have of them in your head is matched by how they are on set, or even sometimes even surpassed.
Absolutely. I mean, just knowing, like, I remember when we shot the first scene together, that I was looking at the monitor and I was like, oh my god, that's Sarah Connor. Like, that's crazy. I was just like elbowing my brother, yeah, like, dude, like Terminator, like, this is crazy. You know?
Now, Glenn is somebody that I've always liked in terms of whether it's on 24, the West Wing, the Transformers films. He just brings such a grounded sense of realism to anything that he's playing. I'm always fascinated by how he portrays those kind of everyman sort of roles. What was it about the Glenn that you really appreciated on set?
Glenn has this sort of like elegant way to sort of read the most mundane line, and he just make it interesting. And he's the type of person that, you know, you just sort of like point the camera at him and he'll give you 10 different versions that are true to the character. And then in the edit room, it's just like amazing, you know?
So for this, as you're coming together, what was your sort of production timeline? How long did you have to shoot this film?
We shot this in 19 days. And then we had like a skeleton crew, which was basically just my brother, me, a camera and a camera assistant shooting B-roll. You know, when she's running through the tunnels, like certain establishing shots here and there.
When you, certainly, I feel like the thing as we're talking about like genres and comic book films, like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where they have that the luxury of having a bigger budget where they can do the principal photography, start putting things together in the edit room, kind of see what's working, maybe something that they missed, and then go back and do some pickup shoots for that. What's it like when you know that you have 19 days and like you've got to make sure that you're getting everything that you need because there's not going to be a chance to kind of come back and do any tweaks?
Yeah, absolutely. It's super stressful, especially because like how we were just talking before this is that there's days that are great and you get ahead of time or you get like extra shots, you know, and there's days that things go wrong and, you know, it starts to rain or there's equipment that's not working and then you're just basically waiting for the equipment to work and you're just sitting down burning man hours. Yeah. So you show up with a plan, you plan as much as you can, you show up with a plan and a shot list. And then based on how much time you have left on the day, you realize that you have to pick certain shots on that shot list because some of them you're just never going to get there. And so, yeah, it is really stressful. It sort of like forces you to like think on your feet. But from there, sometimes you do get this creative inspiration of like, you know what? Let's just throw this out the window. We know what we want. We know what's the intention of the scene. Let's do a one-er. Let's just do a one-er. Let's rehearse it really well, and let's just do a one-er. And that was not the plan, but then you are happy with the outcome. There's times where, no, that's not, didn't work out. Keep shooting, keep doing coverage, and pray for the best.
I would have to imagine there were the ideas of like locations and things like that too, where being forced to kind of decide what you need actually to shoot starts making you think like, well, can we make this scene still happen in this location?
Yeah.
What can we tweak around to make this happen? I got to feel like that's when you're put in that kind of box, even though it can be frustrating at times, I feel like it can also be a great source of creativity as well. Nobody wants to be forced in that box, but do you enjoy the experience of at least put in that box and sometimes being forced to make those tough decisions?
Absolutely. I mean, I can tell you one story that one time, it wasn't for Curvature, it was for a different project, where we went and we scouted the location on Friday. We sort of like blocked it out, and then we were going to go shoot on Monday. And then over the weekend, a construction crew showed up and just like demolished the whole place and then left all the construction equipment as well. So, you know, we were all on Monday, and like the place is literally just gone. It looks like a war zone. And what did we do? Well, you sort of use what you have there. And then all of a sudden, it became instant production value that you didn't have.
Yeah, that's true. It could ruin everything. Yeah, this is perfect.
Yeah. You just got to learn how to, like, take it. Because obviously, the first initial thought is like, what? Like, this is crazy. And then you're like, all right, let's get everyone to start pushing stuff to the side. And that's what it's going to look like. And you just roll with it. Yeah.
So you go through principal photography, you go to post, you start putting the film together. Being the editor, do you like to get hands-on in the editing room, or do you just like, nope, I get the editor, I'm just going to take a back seat and just watch that and just have notes?
I think being an editor myself in the past allows me to, like I said, talk to the editor in certain ways that we are able to understand each other in a more, you know, I guess, technical way. But you always want someone who wasn't on set and doesn't know the story from your perspective, so that way they can bring ideas to the table, right? When you show up to location and you know what the orientation of the room is and you shoot it a certain way, then it's his job for the editor to sort of look at the footage and sort of like, oh, piece it together in a way that for him it makes sense because he wasn't on set and he doesn't know the orientation of everything. So I think it's always better when you have an additional set of eyes and a different fresh perspective on what you think it, you know, the scene is, because then that way you're able to understand it from outside of your perspective.
So you finished production for Curvature. It came out February 23rd. Where is it available for audiences to come and find it if they're looking to go see Curvature?
It's available on any digital outlet like iTunes and basically if you have a cable box, it's on demand. Any digital platform, really.
And your Curvature, you've signed, sealed, and delivered. I guess with the expression is like your film is never done, it's just taken away from you. Do you feel that's the case?
That's the case for everything, even the screenplay. The screenplay is never done. You keep working on it, and then at one point you just got to start shooting it, and then the editing process starts, and at one point you're gonna run out of money, so you got to seal it. Same thing with the music. You know, you could keep making different versions of the music, but at one point you have to stop doing, you know, the creative process and turn it in and let it be what it is.
So you finished with Curvature, but you're not done. One in a Million Productions is working on another production as well. What is the new film that you're doing?
Are we talking about the ones that I'm directing or the ones I'm producing?
Well, the one that you're directing next.
Okay, then the one I'm directing next, I'm not allowed to say too much about it, but I can tell you that it's a horror film and it's going to be crazy. It's a crazy idea. It's definitely very different from Curvature, but I'll be happy to bring it here and talk
Please.
About it with you.
Absolutely. Any hints of when you're going to start shooting?
No, not yet. Okay. We're still like in that process.
Oh, I'm excited. But I imagine getting a chance to do a horror film, the excitement of doing practical effects.
Oh, yes. See, that's the difference between watching a horror movie and making a horror movie. When you're watching it, it's sort of like this, you know, violence maybe or creepy type of vibe because you get scared. That's the whole point. When you're making it, it's the most fun time you can think of. Like, getting splattered with fake blood and, you know, you yell cut and everyone starts laughing. It's a whole different experience, seriously.
Not enough blood. Keep throwing out more blood.
Yeah, or the prosthetics. I it's really cool when you start working with prosthetics and you cut someone's arm off or something like that. It's always fun, you know? Never not knowing if it's going to work or not and you got to redo it and, like, hide the hose where, like, you're pumping the blood and little things that, you know, when you're the audience member, you're not really thinking of those things. But when you're shooting it, it's really fun because it's really challenging.
That's true. It's a totally different experience. In the theater, you want them screaming, but on the set, you're either laughing or you're cheering when somebody's getting their arm cut off and it works perfectly. Yeah, you
exactly.
Did it.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. When there's a scene like that where it's like a big gag and then it actually works, people clap at the end. Like you yell cut and everyone's so happy. Everyone takes pictures. Yeah, it's really fun.
So, Diego, if they want to keep up to date with what you're doing, whether in terms of Curvature or your new film in production, or whether it's you're directing or producing, what's the best place to find you in social media?
Social media. I'm actually not a big social media person.
All right.
That's
fine. Or for your website, then. For
Halley's Brothers.
Yep. All right.
Yeah. We'll make announcements there and you know.
That's fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest has been Diego Halavis. Please check out Curvature. It is a really cool take on the time travel genre. Well worth your time. Come on. Plus, you got Linda Hamilton. Come on. Sarah Connors herself is in this film. That should tell you right now that it's a cool time travel movie. I've been your host, Frank Moran. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at HappyGoJackie. We'll be back with another episode of I Talk Movies right here on Popcorn Talk. Take care, everybody.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. Views expressed here are those of the host only, not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.